Okay, so our next presenter is Emily Ellman. She's research analyst at Reproductive Health Program in the Oregon Public Health Division. And the title of her presentation, if it hasn't changed, Implementing Medicaid Citizenship Documentation Requirements and a Family Planning Waiver, Oregon's Experience.
It's a lengthy title. So I'm actually going to move a state up from California and talk about Oregon's equivalent in a lot of senses of the Family Pact program. And I have no relationships to disclose. I want to begin by giving you, for those of you who aren't familiar with family planning Medicaid waivers, provide some context and background. Beginning in the early 1990s, a series of Medicaid expansions expanded family planning services by allowing states to implement programs to offer family planning services to women who would have otherwise not been eligible, either because of coming off of Medicaid postpartum 60 days or because their income didn't meet the federal poverty level thresholds of regular Medicaid. And the majority of states that offer Medicaid waiver programs are income-based. And unlike Title X, which is sort of the U.S.'s main only dedicated source of public funding for family planning services, Medicaid family planning waivers really narrowly define services to those falling under contraceptive management only. And so you can see here a list of what are the sort of core contraceptive management services in family planning waivers. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, matches all services at 90%. So the state is then responsible for pulling down a 10% match for that. So Oregon's Family Planning Waiver, or the Family Planning Expansion Project, which I'll refer to as FPEP from here on out, began in 1999 and is an income-based waiver. So it covers both women, men, and teens who are at 185% of the federal poverty level. We're on a much smaller scale than California, so we have a network of 55 agencies and 168 clinics delivering services throughout the state. And our providers are a mix of public health departments, FQHCs, Planned Parenthood affiliates, and private providers. And so more than two-thirds of the sites who are providing FPEP services are safety net providers whose federal grant funding, like Title X or HRSA, require them to serve anyone seeking care regardless of ability to pay. And this will actually be an important point that I'm going to come back to later, so just keep that in mind. FPEP enrolls clients at the point of service, so at the clinic site, and prescriptions for birth control must be dispensed on site. So this is really about ensuring access easily for family planning clients. So now I want to give a little bit of background about the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. And this was an act of the federal government. And one of the provisions of this act was, one part of this was to require U.S. citizens applying for or renewing Medicaid coverage are required to present satisfactory documentary evidence of citizenship. And presumably, this legislation was aimed at preventing non-U.S. citizens from accessing federally funded programs and thereby reducing Medicaid fraud. Although there really was little previous evidence of Medicaid fraud by non-citizens. And CMS released their interim guidance about a month before implementation was required, so it really did not give states sufficient time to sort of plan and implement the major changes that were going to to be needed. And one of the things they did was outline a very complex hierarchy of acceptable documentation. And this is our, and you can't read this probably, which is kind of the point. This was the checklist that we developed for providers outlining the four tiers of acceptable documentation. And it's complicated. And this is something that clinic staff, because they're enrolling clients on site, are dealing with.
Okay, so we have the DRA requirements, and then we had concurrently two additional eligibility changes that came about at the same time when CMS was renewing FPEP's waiver. And I'm going to talk about those two right now. Oops. Oh, no, I'm going to talk. Yeah. Let me go back. Thank you. So, prior to implementation, adults were required to provide Social Security numbers, and it was voluntary for teens. And about 80% of our teens were providing Social Security numbers. We didn't really have any way to measure if those were invalid or incorrect or duplicates. But the mandatory collection was really for teens was really a big hit because not a lot of teens know their Social Security numbers and may be fearful or reluctant to ask their parents for their Social Security numbers. The third change that came about was also the requirement that individuals with creditable insurance were no longer eligible for FPEP. And so what I mean by creditable insurance is if a client has coverage for contraceptive management, meaning family planning visit and supplies, and this is regardless of the level of coverage. So it doesn't really consider clients that may have limited prescription coverage or high deductibles. If they have coverage that covers any part of both visits and supplies, they were no longer eligible for FPEP. So because I have a lot to cover, I'm going to let you read this and not go over it. But one thing I do want to add that is in addition to these activities, program staff at the state level really did a fair amount of provider training in anticipation of rollout of these three eligibility changes. We conducted webinars with database demos. We conducted conference calls, emails, newsletters, website updates. I think our relationship with the providers is one of the things that characterizes our program as so successful. Because we're a small state and we have a small network, we have a really close relationship. And because we're one of the few states that actually administers our Medicaid program along with our Title X program and not out of the Medicaid office, we sort of try to have a continuity of services for our providers. So they really know us well. So one of the things that we did in anticipation was implement an eligibility database, which is a centralized web-based database accessible to all providers so that they could coordinate client enrollment info statewide. The database collects enrollment information, so, and particularly the Social Security number, insurance status, and citizenship and verification status, so that the database then makes determinations of eligibility based on the presence of that information. And since all clinics have access to the database, eligibility needs to only be established once per year for a client, and citizenship status needs to be verified once at all. So clients can go to different clinics without having to re-give all the information. And this is just a screen capture, essentially, of what the clinic staff are seeing, what they're entering information into, and I have the arrows pointing at those sort of three fields in which the eligibility changes were about. So the main thing that I want to talk about is the innovative things that we as a state, and I think we really were innovative in our thinking about how to really reduce the burden of these changes on family planning clients. And I'm going to talk about these three strategies in detail. The first was the creation of something we call the one-time exception visits, and we're the only state to offer this. And what this is that clients are able to access a full family planning visit and obtain birth control method of their choice at that first visit if all eligibility criteria have been met except for citizenship documentation. So what we've been finding is, not a lot of people are walking around with their birth certificates and passports in their back pocket. And so they would come to the clinic and be told, about these requirements, but still be able to be seen. Because they're not eligible in the eyes of CMS, we pull down 100% state general funds to cover this service. When the client comes back with their documentation, then they're enrolled for a full year of
of eligibility. And I think this really demonstrates the state's commitment to making sure that clients can be seen and get the birth control method of their choice. So this is just a quick graph about the numbers of one-time exception visits that are used. There was a seven-week period in April and May of 2007 where we had insufficient funds to offer the one-time visits, so you see the drop there. And we're slowly leveling off, and I think that's because providers are getting better able to let clients know in advance of requirements, and that clients sort of know. I think, you know, there's now the perception among clients that these are requirements, and so they're coming more prepared. As you might expect, usage is heaviest among teens. We are finding that 65% of clients with one-time visits are returning with documentation, so that's great. And I won't go through this, but it's really is a cost-effective approach to ensure that clients are getting birth control. Okay, the second strategy is organ birth record matching. So for organ-born clients, they can go into the clinic, complete an organ birth record information form that's then entered into the database, and state staff match these requests every 2 weeks against the Oregon birth file for electronic birth certificates. If a match is found, then citizenship is electronically verified in the database. So this has been a great easy way to go ahead and meet the citizenship requirements for clients without them having to actually bring in a physical copy. Just since January 1st of 2008, over 4,000 requests have been submitted and about 3,500 matches have been made. So there's a really good match rate. And this is just an example of the form that the clients complete. Okay, the third and final strategy, and most recent, and also one that I think Oregon is the only state doing, is offering clients who are born out of Oregon the opportunity to request their birth certificates. At the clinic, they complete a birth request form. The clinic sends that information to the state. We then include the application fee, send that off to the Vital Records Office. When we receive the birth certificate, we send that back to the home clinic for storage. And again, this is funded by state general funds. It's about $15. But we figure that this is a small investment in money for a full year's worth of eligibility for clients. So this is these clients then are, you know, reimbursable for the clinics. We've had, since March 1st, about 650 birth certificates received, with the majority of those coming from neighboring states. And this is just a quick screen capture of basically, again, of the database, what the clinics are seeing. So the top one is if they're going to be using a one-time visit for the client, they fill in that little yes bubble. If they actually have documentation, they indicate which tier it is and where the photocopy of the original document is housed. So I want to now pull back a little bit and go back to what the impact of these eligibility changes, these three changes, the citizenship requirements, Social Security number, and creditable insurance, have had on our clients. The dotted line is when the citizenship documents were announced, and the top line is total visits. And you can see we've had a really consistent downward trend of visits. The green line is our FPEP paid visits, and the yellow line are visits covered by other sources of pay. So as you can expect, teens are really taking the brunt of these changes, 41% decrease in clients under 18. I'm not sure what the 26% blip is with a 30 plus, but this is really affecting the teens. So, as I mentioned, presumably the Deficit Reduction Act citizenship requirements was aimed at reducing Medicaid fraud by non-citizens. Oregon's sort of largest immigrant population are Hispanics, so one might expect to see, if there was a whole lot of fraud going on, a decrease in the number of Hispanic clients accessing services. There hasn't been any, so which leads us to believe that there was very little, if any, Medicaid fraud happening. So remember at the beginning I talked about safety net clinics that are required to see clients regardless of their ability to pay. So if a client, it cannot be covered under FPEP, so is not eligible based on one of the requirements, those clinics are going to see them anyway with dwindling Title X funding. So this is a graph showing the increase in those visits in which essentially the clinic is swallowing those costs. We conducted a phone survey of providers shortly after the implementation. So, you know, the providers both, I mean, it's great. I think, you know, this was a huge burden of time and resources on provider staff, but they were, you know, mainly concerned about the impact on clients. So, you know, this I think really points it out well. Our primary concern is that the whole intention was to reduce barriers to at-risk populations, and this is just putting one back in. So now what? There's been some evidence out there about the impact of requirements. Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the uninsured sort of talked to state Medicaid directors who said time needed to determine eligibility, the resources, you know, those were just huge hurdles. There's little current momentum on a national level to get these requirements reversed. Perhaps with a new administration, the possibility of, at the very least, getting an exception to these requirements for family planning Medicaid waivers might be possible. We haven't at this point really seen what the long-term effects of these changes are on reproductive health outcomes like teen pregnancy and what this means for safety net capacity, our safety net providers who are having to sort of swallow the costs of these changes. So we plan on continuing to provide eligibility assistance as long as our general fund support them. And yeah, and hope that there's some changes in the future. So if you have any questions, feel free to contact me afterwards. Thank you.